Start up again on going through the minor prophets. We were doing that a while back, and I kind of switched topics for a little bit, but we're going to be looking at the book of Joel tonight. If y'all want to turn there, it's a fairly short book. There's only three chapters in it. We'll look at the first chapter this evening. So we pronounce the name of this book Joel, and that's Latin. The Hebrew word for that is Yoel, which means Yahweh is God. It's thought that this book was written between 835 and 796 BC. It would have been during the reign of Joash as the king of Judah. And it is written, you know, a lot of the minor prophets are foretelling things to come, and Joel will do that later on in the book. But he writes this prophecy or this book during a locust plague and a drought that's taking place in Judah. And this is something that had already been prophesied about. We'll look at a little later on. But I want to look at the first three verses of Joel chapter 1, if you want to turn there. It says, "The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. Hear this, ye old men, and give all ear, all ye inhabitants of the land. Hath this been in your days, or even in the days of your fathers? Tell ye your children of it, and let your children tell their children, and their children another generation." So, some people believe that it was Joel's opinion that he's drawing this connection between the plague that has hit Judah and God's judgment. But that's not true. A lot of people are misinformed on that. In Acts 2 and verse 16 it says, "But this is what was spoken about through the prophet Joel." That's out of the NET. All the versions of the Bible except for the King James Version say "spoken through," implying that, you know, God was speaking through Joel, that Joel wasn't coming up with these ideas himself, but he was prophesying for God and for Jesus. And then verse 2, it says, he uses the phrase "old men," but specifically calls out the older people. And he says, "Listen up, everyone." He says, "Have any of you ever seen anything like this?" And then he's specifically asking the older people. He says, "Have any of y'all ever seen anything like this?" You know, it tends to lead, oh, I guess more credit or something, if an older person says, "Well, in all my time, in my parents' time, I've never seen anything like this." Well, then you know nothing like this has ever happened in a long time. And that's what he's saying. He's saying, all you old people, have y'all ever seen a plague like this? Have y'all ever seen a drought like this? Because they hadn't. Nothing had been quite this severe. And so he's asking them, have y'all ever seen anything like this? And then he tells them, tell your kids what I'm about to tell you. Tell your kids about what is happening right now. Make sure your kids and their kids know that this was from God. And it's funny that he brings this up. If you look in Exodus chapter 10, verse 2, here Moses and Pharaoh and God are arguing about letting the Israelites go. And Exodus 10, verse 2, it says, and that this is God talking, "And that thou mayest tell in the ears of thy son and of thy son's son what things I have wrought in Egypt, and my signs which I have done among them, that ye may know how that I am the Lord." So God's telling Moses that he's about to send the eighth plague, which would be locusts. And he's telling them, make sure everyone knows that this plague was from me, that I had this power, I have this authority, and that this is what's coming. And make sure their kids know and their kids' kids know. So why do the children need to hear this in Moses' time and during the time of Joel? Well, it's because people forget. The children of Israel, the same people that is being talked to in the book of Joel, is the same people that was in Egypt and experienced the locust plague before. And yet, they had already forgotten. And so, we're all human. We all understand that we need reminding of things. And he's saying, remind your children about what is happening and what's going to come. Verses 4 through 6 of Joel says, "That which is the palmer worm hath left hath the locust eaten. And that which the locust hath left hath the cankerworm eaten. And that which the cankerworm hath left hath the caterpillar eaten. Awake, ye drunkards, and weep. And howl, all you drinkers of wine, because of the new wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. For a nation has come up upon my land, strong and without number, whose teeth are the teeth of a lion, and he hath the cheek teeth of a great lion." Verse 4, he's saying, look around you, there's nothing left. And we'll get in here in a minute, we'll get into the severity of a locust plague and stuff, but he's saying, look around you, there's nothing left. They've come and destroyed everything we have. And he lists four different different names for bugs, depending on what version you're reading of the Bible. But there aren't four stages. Some people believe that, well, he's talking about the four different stages of a locust life. Well, there aren't four stages unless you include the stage of an egg. So that doesn't make sense. Some people believe, well, he's listing four different types of bugs, and they're just supernatural bugs. Again, going to the idea this is more metaphorical and not actually physically happen. But we'll read later in verse 16, he uses the phrase, before your eyes. So the locusts were actually there in front of the children of Judah. And so it's my belief that he lifts these four different names because it's kind of just a common thing to do in the Old Testament. You see it done in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and a few other books. It's called, four is the number of completeness, as it was phrased in some commentaries I read. And it's a common thing done in the Old Testament. If you're listing things, you'll list it in groups of four. If you're describing something, you'll use four different adjectives to describe that thing. But no matter, you know, if these are supernatural beings, if it's talking about four different stages of life or four different bugs entirely, the idea is still the same. Wave after wave of bugs had come in and destroyed everything that they had known. It had completely changed their way of life. In verse 5, he's saying, you know, all you people that are enjoying drinking so much, you better start crying now because you're in trouble. Because this year's vineyards is all destroyed. There's nothing new coming for you. And you see this, I guess, type of phrasing or delivery of the message in a lot of the minor prophets. I don't know if y'all remember, but when we were studying in Nahum chapter 3 and verse 14, it's foretelling the destruction of Nineveh. And God speaking through Nahum, is almost taunting the people. He says in Nahum 3 and verse 14, he says, draw the waters for the siege, fortify thy strongholds, go into clay and tread the mortar, make strong the brickland. So here he's telling them, get ready, you're about to be destroyed, as if they could do something to prevent themselves from being destroyed. And it's the same thing. He's kind of teasing the drunkards here. He's saying, y'all better start complaining now and crying now, because this year's wine is not going to be here for you. And then in verse 6, he refers to the locusts as a great nation. You know, he's starting to foretell this destruction by a nation that actually is going to take place that we see later on in chapter 2. But there's this great army that has come and destroyed the land as they know it. And it starts drawing the similarities between the locusts and their destruction. And he uses the phrase, my land. Again, we have to remember this is God speaking through Joel. This isn't Joel's land. This is God's land. This is the promised land. God had allowed them to enter there. And he says, where you've been living, in my land, this great army has come in to destroy you. And it says that this invader, it's innumerable. There's thousands and thousands. It says they can't be counted. And it has the ability to destroy everything. It compares it with having the teeth of a lion. You know, if you think about a lion or any large predator, when it goes to eat its meat, it can just destroy it easily. It has sharp teeth. It can just wipe out everything in its path. So for a second, I want to talk about a locust plague. And I knew they were destructive and things like that, and I started digging more and more into this, and I didn't quite realize how destructive they were. But in 1915, there was a locust plague covered Palestine and Syria. It was from the border of Egypt to the Taurus Mountains. And I couldn't figure out exactly how big of a area that was, but it was a very large area. It was noted that one swarm, this is one wad of locusts, you might say, could cover 460 square miles. That's a lot of bugs. That's a lot of bugs. And there was a few authors or writers that were over in Palestine and Syria during that time that worked for the National Geographic. And they documented all this and took pictures of the plague as it came through the towns and things like that. And in the beginning of their article, the writer, he quotes Joel in the descriptions of the plagues and the locusts and things like that. But this is a little bit long, but I want to read two paragraphs out of the article from National Geographic. And this is talking about the plague of locusts that went through there. It says, in the next phase of the plague, female flying locusts laid eggs in the ground, giving rise to the second and most devastating stage of the invasion. On April 19th, 1915, 1915, local authorities issued a proclamation obligating men from age 16 to 60 to gather and turn in several pounds of eggs each or pay a fine, all in an effort to limit the multitude of eggs soon to hatch. Now listen to this. Tens of thousands of new locusts could potentially be produced from eggs laid in just a few meters square of earth. So in just a few square yards of earth, it says there could be tens of thousands of locusts just in that little area. The young men of the American colony dutifully set about meeting the requirement. Soon the newly hatched larva emerged, wingless, and began moving in droves so vast, viewing them made some witnesses motion sick. These crawlers advanced all over the face of the earth, consuming everything edible in their path. They blanketed the road near Jerusalem Railroad Station. They mobilized in countless rows like armies, leaving large portions of previously thriving landscapes devoid of vegetation. Former shade trees were rendered leafless. The locusts burrowed inside the trunks of palms and cactus. They invaded beehives, consuming honey and bees alike. And the article goes on and on talking about the destruction that they reaped on the land, and then also their, I guess, the people's attempts to fight them off. And I want to show a few pictures, and this is all from the 1915 article. Here's a picture of the swarm of locusts, and it's an old picture, so it doesn't quite do it justice. But then you have a picture. This is a picture. These people are trying to gather the locusts. Locusts are like grasshoppers. They fly a little bit, but not a whole lot. And so they're trying to gather them up in the ground, and they would funnel them into these boxes and try to catch them like that. So here is, the picture was titled The Garden of Gethsemane. So here you have this pretty garden and things like that. And then here's a picture after the locusts have gone through, before and after. They've completely, destroyed everything. Here's a picture of some trees before and after. This picture I'd seen when I was in elementary and middle school, and I'd never realized the full story behind it, but this is a tree in Palestine before and after. It looks like it's winter. Everything has gone from it. But, I have those pictures and the quotes from those articles just so we can realize the amount of destruction that they can cause. We read about the plagues that go through Egypt, and we kind of understand, all the bugs or the frogs or the darkness or whatever took place, but, like I say, picture's worth a thousand words. It really describes to us how swift and how strong God's punishment really is. So now we'll pick up back up in verse 7 of Joel chapter 1. It starts talking about the destruction that these locusts are going to reap on are currently reaping on the land. Verse 7, it says, "He hath laid my vine waste and barked my fig tree. He hath made it clean bare and cast it away. The branches thereof are made white. Lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. The meat offering and the drink offering is cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests, the Lord ministers mourn." So in verse 7, in the King James Version, it uses the phrase, "barked my fig tree." Barked means splintered. It's possible, I did some research, people have different opinions, but it's possible that, so fig trees, which are common over there, they have orchards with figs in them, fig trees and fig wood is very brittle and soft. And so it's possible for these soft fig limbs to be broken by the weight of the locust on them. There'd be so much that the limbs would just break. And so that's the splintering that takes place. But no matter if they're just stripped of their bark or if these branches are actually broken, the trees were destroyed. They were useless. They served no purpose for the people. Then it says that they were clean, bare, and made white. So the locusts, they would first eat the vines and the leaves. That'd be the softest, most palatable things for them to eat. And so once all those things are gone, they'd move on to eating the bark. And the new growth would have the softest bark, and the new growth would be at the tops of the trees. So the locusts would start at the tops of the trees and eat all the bark that they could. And if you've ever seen wood is normally brown when it has the bark on it, but when that bark is stripped away and the sun shines on it, it bleaches it. It turns the wood white. And so these trees, they looked white because all the bark would be stripped off and the sun would bleach it and turn them white. So that's the clean, bare, and the made white that it's talking about in verse 7. Verse 8, it says, "Lament like a virgin girded with a sackcloth for the husband of her youth." So he's telling the priest and everyone listening, he says, be as sad as a woman who's just lost her fiance, pretty much. You know, this was, it's obviously a great tragedy in today's culture, but it was more so in Hebrew culture. If this took place, the woman was supposed to observe something called Shavah. And this would be 7 days of mourning, and they must perform it, perform certain actions, and then not perform certain actions within those 7 days. And the family and the friends of that woman were supposed to do certain things and ceremonies with her. But here it compares a woman losing her man, a bride losing her husband. You know, we are the bride of Christ. This the land of Judah, the Israelite, or the land of Judah, these people, they were losing their husband. They were losing God. They had no way to serve him anymore. All the things they used for offerings, they no longer had. God was casting them aside. And so he's drawing that comparison between the bride and the husbandman, in that they were losing their husband. They were losing their means of support, their provider, their protector. They were losing what they solely relied upon. And that's why they should have been so sad, because their way of life was about to change forever. In verse 9, there was not enough food for the people to survive, much less use for their offerings to God. The priests mourned because their job was solely to make these sacrifices, and that's how they made a living. They received either a portion of the sacrifice or a portion of that tithe. So that's how they made their money, and that's how they were able to eat. And so now there was nobody making sacrifices, so the priests, they no longer had a job. They no longer had any way to support themselves. Starting in verse 10 of chapter 1, it says, the field is wasted, the land mourneth, for the corn is wasted, the new wine is dried up, and the oil languisheth. Be ye ashamed, O ye husbandmen, howl, O ye vine dressers, for the wheat and for the barley, because the harvest of the field is perished. The vine is dried up, and the fig tree languisheth, the pomegranate tree, the palm tree also, and the apple tree, even all the trees of the field are withered, because joy is withered away from the sons of men. So again, he's just describing the amount of destruction, the devastation that takes place through the land. Their entire way of life was changed. There was no corn, no vineyards. There's no wheat, barley, figs, pomegranates, palm trees, apples. All the trees, not just the fruit, but all the trees were wiped out. In the quote from the National Geographic article, it talked about them even eating the cactus. And I meant to have a picture of that in there, but they would eat the cactus and the fruit and just, it would entirely be gone. They would eat the palm trees, everything. You know, they didn't eat just the sweet fruit, but everything was gone. Everything was food to the locusts. You know, we get our food and building materials, a lot of it from other parts of the world. So, you know, if a locust invasion came in or some natural disaster, well, we'd still be able to get food. We'd still be able to get in building supplies and things like that. But that's not how it was for them. They relied upon their farmland right around them. And so they couldn't just bring in food. They couldn't have a shipload of food come in right away and then be helped out. They were at loss for what to do. Verse 13 through 14 says, gird yourselves and lament, ye priests. Howl, ye ministers of the altar. Come, lie all night in sackcloth, ye ministers of my God. For the meat offering and the drink offering is withholden from the house of your God. Sanctify ye a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land into the house of the Lord your God, and cry unto the Lord. You know, God, as I was studying this, God has created a world in which we were always going to be humbled by his creation. And I mean that, you know, we have health problems, we can go see a doctor and they can do tests or surgeries or whatever and usually fix our problem. You know, if we have a financial problem, we can go to a bank or a friend and get some money and figure that out. Yet, you know, natural disasters, whether it's a plague, a tornado, a hurricane, things like that, you can see it coming and you can run and hide, but it's still going to wipe out plenty of things. You know, a tornado, you know, it's flat around here. You can see the tornado coming from a long ways and they can predict it. Say, this week, there's a high chance of tornadoes. And then as soon as it's spotted, everyone knows that a tornado is spotted. That tornado still goes and either tears up fences or kills animals or tears down houses or destroys cities. You know, you can see it coming, but you can't do anything about it. We get the idea that we're, you know, we've conquered the earth and things like that, and yet God's creation still humbles us every time. And God had warned the priest, had warned the people of Judah that this was going to happen. In Deuteronomy 28 and verse 38 through 39, it says, "Thou shalt carry much seed out into the field, and shalt gather but little in, for the locust shall consume it. Thou shalt plant vineyards and dress them, but shalt neither drink of the wine nor gather the grapes, for the worm shall eat them." In 1 Kings chapter 8, it's also predicted that these locusts were going to come and destroy them. So that's part of the reason I think that he's telling the priests and the ministers to howl and lament, because they should have seen it coming. You know, their job was to be in the Word, to understand the prophecies, understand God's Word, and things like that. And he'd warned them, and yet they'd still strayed away from God, and the locust was still coming to get them. In verse 13 and 14, he's also, he tells them to fast. He tells them to gird themselves with a sackcloth. He tells them to realize what has happened and what they've done, and they should be asking God for forgiveness, and that's their only hope, that's their only lifeline, that's their only way out. You know, it often takes a great shock or a tragedy for us to turn to God, to humbly get on our knees and ask God for help. And that's what it took for the Israelites and for Judah. You know, we constantly see throughout the Old Testament, the Israelites, you know, they're following God, and then they get cocky and get the big head and start doing what they want, and then they get put into captivity. Some nation comes in and takes them as slaves. And so then they're humbled, and they turn back to God. They say, "God, we need your help. We realize we goofed. We're sorry." And God helps them out. And then it's the same cycle over and over again. It's the same cycle for us. You know, a lot of times when we pray, we only pray when we're having trouble. We don't pray when we're super excited or happy or blessed. A lot of times we turn to God when we need help. And that's what the Israelites and the children of Judah did. Joel 1 and verse 15 says, "Alas for the day, for the day of the Lord is at hand, and it is a destruction from the Almighty shall it come." So the day of the Lord, this obviously isn't judgment day in that the earth will be destroyed and everybody is judged. The phrase "day of the Lord" is used 29 times in the King James Version. And whenever that phrase is used, it's for telling some form of judgment either on this earth or after this earth is gone. And it's always a matter of context, knowing which one it's talking about. But depending on where you lie with God determines whether this will be a good or a bad day, this day of judgment or day of the Lord. You know, Judah was being punished and about to be punished even worse. And so this would be, as it says here in verse 15, a day of destruction for them. And here we see Joel kind of slowly transitioning or leading into chapter 2, which would be foretelling the nation that would come in and wipe them out. Starting verse 16 of Joel 1, it says, "Is not the meat cut off before our eyes? Yea, joy and gladness from the house of our God. The seed is rotten under their clods. The garners are laid desolate. The barns are broken down, for the corn is withered. How do the beasts groan? The herds of cattle are perplexed, because they have no pasture. Yea, the flocks of sheep are made desolate." Their way of life was, you know, that they farmed their own food. They grew their own fruits and vegetables, and their way of life was destroyed quickly right in front of them. You know, it wasn't a slow drought, and it takes place over time, and production of things starts going downhill. You know, just overnight, these bugs came in and just destroyed everything. And what the locust didn't destroy, the drought had killed or had withered up. It says, verse 17, it says, "The seed is rotten under their clods." So this, you know, they plant the seed, and the seed is rotten. And also, I don't know if I'm looking into this too much in drawing things, but you know, when you have dirt clods, that's not good soil necessarily to plant seeds into. You want those seeds to be able to touch the soil around it. When you have clods, you have lots of air pockets and things like that. And so the ground wasn't good to be planted in. The seeds that they were planting had withered up and died, and they weren't going to be able to produce anything. And all the buildings, it says the barns and things were broken down because there wasn't anything to put in the barns because they weren't producing anything. So nobody saw any need to fix up the barns. In verse 18, it uses the word perplexed. Other versions use, say, wonder and confusion. Again, this happened so quickly. In verse 16, it says, before our eyes, you know, these animals, they went to sleep one night in their lush green pasture, and they woke up the next morning, and it was dirt. They were perplexed. It'd be like if, you know, you went to the grocery store and you put all your food in the fridge, and you went back to your fridge the next morning, it was all gone. They were confused. It was just all gone. All their sustenance, they weren't able to get anymore. And then finally, the last two verses of Joel chapter 1, it says, O Lord, to thee will I cry. This is Joel talking. O Lord, to thee will I cry, for the fire hath devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and the flame hath burned all the trees of the field. The beasts of the field cry also unto thee, for the rivers of water are dried up, and the fire hath devoured the pastures of wilderness. So again, this fire it talks about, there's lots of discussion whether or not it was metaphorical, and I believe there actually was physical fire taking place. It makes sense that there would have been fire with the drought going on. Whether it was people setting fire to fields trying to destroy the locusts, or, you know, say there was lightning or just dry conditions, I believe the fire took place. And the phrase wilderness, whenever we think of wilderness, we think of a desert, you know, a few sticks here and there, a puddle of water, but, you know, nothing else. But here the wilderness is also translated as prairie or a steppe. So it would have been flat country with lots of grass, normally lush grass. And so it would make sense that the fire could come in and destroy lots and lots of land. But, you know, in verse 19, Joel rightfully recognizes that God is the only one that can help or save them. Previously, he was telling the priest and the ministers to call unto the Lord to fast, to realize who was doing this and what they should do. And Joel rightfully recognizes that God is the only one that can save them, the only one can help them. You know, if you're looking at this story and all the stories of the Bible, but this one I think more so since I did more research into the locusts and what a plague can do. You know, God, he doesn't mess around. You know, sometimes you'll be sitting at a restaurant and there's a bratty kid over here in the corner, and the parents say, if you don't stop doing that, I'm going to spank you. And say, so I'm going to count to three, and then they count to 10, and they don't do anything. You know, God's not like that. If he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. He warned them in Deuteronomy and 1 Kings that he was going to send this locust plague if they didn't, you know, get their act together. And they didn't, and he did. You know, God, if he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. And so we need to be a lot more fearful than Judah was, or the Israelites were, or than we have been in times past. You know, Joel knew that God was who him and Judah and the Israelites needed to turn to, and that's something that they should have kept in the front of their minds. It's something we need to keep in the front of our minds. Sometimes forget that the Bible is true. We think of it just as a storybook, and so, you know, Judgment Day doesn't have as big of an effect on our lives and the way we act and the way we think, but we need to remember, just because we don't see miracles or we don't have these terrible plagues like they did in the Old Testament, that God is still there, and he will carry out his word and do what he said. And so it's up to us to live godly lives and follow his word to make sure that we don't receive that punishment on the day of the Lord. So that's my study for this evening. I've never looked into the book of Joel before now, and as I think I've started probably with all the minor prophets, I enjoy going through it and seeing how everything coincides with, I guess, other sources of history and things like that. Really enjoyed it. I hope everyone else has enjoyed it, and it's beneficial for everyone. As always, we offer the invitation song if there's someone who has the need of the church. If you come forward while we stand, while we sing.